Blog Talk Radio.
Tomorrow may never come.
for you or me. Life is not a problem. Tomorrow may never show up. For you and me, this life is not a problem. I ain't no perfect man. I'm trying to do the best that I can with what it is I have. I ain't no perfect man. I'm trying to do the best that I can with what it is I have. Put my heart and soul to the song.
Yes, yes.
I hope you feel me where I am and wherever you are. I mean that sincerely. Tomorrow may never come. For you and me, life is not a promise. Tomorrow may never appear. You better hold this very moment.
African Conversations, and I'm your host, Charles Williams, and today we are joined with a great author and media historian and analyst, Mr. Cisco Streetlove. Cisco Streetlove is author of a book titled Yesterday's Shame, The Atlanta Child Murders, and he will be joining us this evening to share with us his insights and regarding his research, regarding the murders and all the details that were hidden from us to lead us to a foregone conclusion. Welcome to African Conversations, Brother Cisco.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Brother Charles, and good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you. You're welcome. Appreciate it, and glad you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to share your information with us.
Hey, you're too kind. I have a lot of free time. It's an honor to be on your show.
Okay. could you tell us how this case caught your attention to be able to begin the research that you took on?
Sure thing, Charles. My family relocated from New Jersey to Metro Atlanta around 1978, late 78. And I grew up in the Atlanta area experiencing the child murders firsthand. For those who don't know, from July of 1979 to, I want to say, May of 1981, there were several young black people who were found dead. They would be missing, then found murdered. Sometimes days later, sometimes months later, throughout the city. And they were all black, and given the time frame, it had only been like a decade or so, you know, once segregation was over. So the first thing people thought was it was the traditional white on black hate crime. The murders allegedly ended around late, I want to say May of 81, after Nathaniel Cater's body was fished out one of the waterways around Atlanta. And the law enforcement, the special task force at the time, they presented Wayne Williams as the prime suspect. He was cast as the most viable suspect around. He was arrested, I want to say, around June 1981. He was swiftly, promptly put on trial, and he was convicted on a cold February Saturday evening in 1982. That was the official story, that Wayne Williams was the Atlanta child killer. And for decades, that's what people assumed. But slowly, surely, a lot of details about the case got out. One of the chief proponents, or the chief critics of the case, were these two white males. One was Chet Detlinger. The other one was Jeff Prue. They teamed together in, I want to say, 82, 83, and they produced this book called The List. The List is the seminal Bible,
right,
per se, of a lot of the critics of the Atlanta child murders case. Around 2005, Lewis Graham, who was one of the detectives in Atlanta, he had become the sheriff of neighboring DeKalb County. He reopened some of the murders because some of the victims, their bodies were found in the cab.
Right.
It made a major headway in the news, but unfortunately nothing came of it. I, at that time, was, you know, exposed to a lot of the details about the child molesters that were on the cusp of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And around 2006, I decided to do research with hopefully the goal to produce the book. And it took, around 6 years later, but here we are. And from the research I uncovered, from the research I put together, from the people I actually got to interview, that's how I produced the book Yesterday's Shame, which I hope will shed a further light on the case where Dettlinger and Prude didn't.
Right. You really went into great detail of painting a portrait of the political and the social climate in your book to help it give us the portrait of how this kind of atmosphere could be conducive for a sexual predators or murderers or these kinds of people to develop out of this southern Atlanta area. Could you tell us more about the neighborhoods and the community as it went transfer over from more a gay community into a black community? I think the southeast side of Atlanta.
Sure. Okay, this is, if you were to visit Atlanta today, it's a drastically altered city from how it was yesterday. Circa the late 70s, even up until as the city hosted the Olympics, Atlanta was a city that was 70% black, okay?
Okay.
The white people who did not work in the city didn't want to have anything to do with it. And you can imagine white flight was expressed to the fullest by the 1970s, 1980s. A lot of white people who would have lived in Atlanta, they moved to DeKalb County, then they moved outward furthermore to Cobb County, which is on the northwest of Atlanta, and Gwinnett County, which is on, I want to say, the extreme northeast to the
yeah.
city. I don't even think Gwinnett borders Atlanta. It borders DeKalb.
Yeah, then my sister lives.
Yeah. And basically, Atlanta at the time, even though the downtown area, the central business district was thriving, you had a lot of housing projects. You had a lot of neighborhoods, believe it or not, like Cabbage Town, which was predominantly white, but it was basically a poor community. Between Cabbage Town and the housing projects like the Bowen Homes, East Lake Meadows, the Grady Homes, that basically went from the east to the southwest part of the city, you had a lot of poor black people. And like you alluded to, Charles, it was basically a pedophile's paradise. One of the things that I found out and I was exposed to, you would have these guys that would come into the city. They would use the hotels because Atlanta at the time, it was a major, major hub of the hospitality trade of America. It was, I want to say, the third busiest convention destination. It was right behind New York City and Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have a lot of conventioners coming into the city. You would have a lot of the white people, amongst others, who would come into the city to score drugs, and it didn't stop with the drugs. They would have sex with people, and it wasn't the run-of-the-mill prostitution, you know, the heterosexual prostitution that a lot of people are used to. A lot of it was having sex with boys. So, when you look at the Atlanta child murders, once you get past the fact that the victims are black, you will find that from 1980 to 1981, there's a distinct change in the victimology. As the murders continued, the latter victims were older. They were in their late teens to Nathaniel Cater's age, their late 20s. And I spoke to a lot of people. I uncovered a lot of news from the archives, and basically the murder case was a sex ring, a whole homosexual pedophilic sex ring that was purposely dissolved for whatever reason. There are strong allegations that the latter victims were recruiting the younger victims early on, and then they were... Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
I was going with you. I was following you. I think you were getting at why these victims were older. Go ahead.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
They were basically the procurers of the younger victims. It was a multi-tiered sex ring where you had the older kids recruiting the younger kids. The younger kids were murdered, and to quiet up everybody, the older kids were systematically liquidated.
Exactly. Basically, we're cleaning up the operation.
Yes, sir.
Firing everybody, basically.
Yes. For those who have heard about the case, a lot of people instantly point to this hardcore racist family called the Sanders Clan. They were these white people, these white brothers, cousins, and the father, his brother, which would be their uncle. They were hardcore, you know, Klansmen from, I believe it was Mountain View, Georgia, north of the city, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
They were drug dealers, pedophiles, everything bad under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
They're the basis of the Spin magazine article that came out around 85, 86, which also inspired the movie Who Killed Atlanta's Missing and Murdered Children that starred Gregory Hines and Jim Belushi.
Okay.
The problem with the Sanders treatment is that by the third, fourth murder, you had people in the community that were leery of white people already.
Mm-hmm.
Our people, you know, they may have been impoverished, but they weren't stupid. A lot of people grew up knowing about the racism, you know, in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time, you know, there were like just three is too many black kids turned up missing and then murdered, people were suspicious of white people.
Mm-hmm.
Coming into the city. So what I'm basically saying is that the Sanders, when you hear about that, that's a ruse. Don't necessarily buy into that theory. Charles Sanders, he was shown in some archival footage. He's basically a pedophile. He is caught on the GBI tape speaking to his brother, and his brother says he's, you know, you're going to get another kid. It is my opinion and my research, I hope, backs me up, that when they say on the wiretap he's going to get another kid, he's basically going to have sex with a boy.
Okay.
Because that's what the Sanders did. What is more apparent is that a lot of the victims, they were linked into not one, but several child molesters, pedophiles who operated in the Atlanta area as part of a wider orchestrated sex ring. In this sex ring, it was concentric. It was like two circles. One was a predominantly white ring. The other one was predominantly black. The white ring was orchestrated by three guys from East Point, Georgia. John David Wilcoxon, Nathaniel Francis Hardy, or Frank Hardy, and Lionel St. Louis. They were the affiliates of the Sanders clan.
Okay.
So when you hear about how, you know, Luby Jeter and Earl Lee Terrell were linked to Charles Sanders as well as John David Wilcoxon, they were handled by that faction. Another player who may have been part of this ring was an individual who is known as Wyatt Earp. He was a white guy who would come into the city, have sex with kids, as well as do drugs. He is basically suspected in murdering Atlanta victim Charles Stevens. Charles Stevens was, his body was allegedly seen in the back of this Wyatt Earp character's car. And it was seen like, you know, the kid was already dead.
Right. I remember that.
And now the predominantly black part of the ring, that's a bit more convoluted. A number of the kids, the victims, as it were, they were hanging out in an area called Gray Street. This area, for those who don't know, it was an actual neighborhood that existed, I want to say, just around the vicinity of the Georgia Dome. Basically, it's no longer there.
Right.
But there were two houses along Gray Street. One was a nondescript bungalow-style city house. The other one was this real rundown shack of a house. Both houses were owned by a man named Tom Terrell. He was also known as Uncle Tom. He was a 63-year-old black pedophile. Terrell lived in the rundown shack of a house. The story is convoluted, but I'll try and elaborate and be as succinct as possible, Charles.
Okay.
This is allegedly what happened. When Patrick Baltazar went missing, his body was recovered in DeKalb County just outside of Buckhead. It was basically at this office plaza, office square along Buford Highway. You can see it on Interstate 85 if you're driving between DeKalb County going to, you know, North Druid Hills Road, and when you veer into, you know, North Druid Hills, that'll take you to Buckhead. You'll see this office plaza from the interstate. Well, that was in DeKalb County. Dick Hand, who was the commissioner of DeKalb, he was at odds with the special task force. he conducted his own investigation and went to the media. He reported that Baltazar and at least 10 other kids at the time, this was around like March, April of 81, 10 or so kids had frequented the houses on Gray Street. There were two other guys that were part of this scenario. They were roommates in the nondescript house on Gray Street. One was Larry Marshall. Larry Marshall himself is a gay man. For whatever reason, Larry Marshall fled to Hartford, Connecticut. He was allegedly threatened by one of the people in the ring. He bolted out of Atlanta to Hartford. The other one was this guy named Jerry Thornton, another black man. He looks like he was younger at the time than Tom Terrell. But he, if you read the list, there's a man named Frankie Mealy. The differences between Frankie Mealing and Jerry Thornton are tangible, or maybe not so tangible, because Jerry Thornton was presented to the media, to the local television, national TV networks, as this guy who was just a casual observer. He was doing no wrong, and he witnessed a lot of this behavior. But in the list written by Krug and Dettlinger, Frankie Mealing, who basically matches up with Jerry Thornton, he acknowledges having sex with Timothy Hill. Timothy Hill is one of the keys to the case in that he knew a lot of the victims. He was a known, I want to say, bisexual, even though he was 13 years old. He slept with Terrell and Thornton / Mealing and another man before he went missing and was ultimately found murdered. Marshall was extradited back to Atlanta, and he tried to work out a deal with law enforcement.
Okay.
And he basically painted a picture that the kids were at the Gray Street properties taking part in the drug trade and having sex with, at the time, like they said on the news, having sex with men for money. Two other individuals that were a part of this ring were Shirley McGill. She was a white woman from Miami.
Right.
And a black male who was her ex-boyfriend, who, in some accounts, the best we can go by, his name was Parnell Tram. And this guy actually existed.
Yeah.
I don't know whether his name was actually Parnell Tram, but yeah, he's an actual person. These people, along with Tom Terrell, they were part of a cult. That they were molesting the kids. They were even sacrificing the kids.
Okay.
And McGill bolted from the ring and went to Roy Ennis and the FBI when she allegedly heard Parnell Tram saying that he was going to kill two kids. Two kids were basically on tap to be killed. Larry Rogers and Eddie Duncan. And bigger than day, they were found murdered. So you had these two concentric sex rings, one predominantly white, one predominantly black, that was preying on minors throughout the city of Atlanta. And that's the sex ring that I talk about in the book.
Right. So we have this one that fled, went to Connecticut. He was brought back, extradited back to the Atlanta area, turned informant.
Yes.
And which brought to light the cult out of with the interracial couple.
Yes.
And during this time, and that was probably the beginning of exposing to probably people who were, you know, investigating the case for the true purpose of solving the murders. That how vast and deep this particular crime syndicate was functioning.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Now, and so how did I guess could you bring to play how local activist groups like CORE and STOP working in tandem, you know, with local people to try to bring resolution was. From my reading, I consider the activities were thwarted by APD. Like when STOP had the Bat Squad, they were doing street patrols, and the police ordered them to stop the street patrols.
Yes.
Because, you know, it appeared to me that they wanted to keep the people from being vigilant and observant of what's really going on in the street. Because, you know, if they stand around watching, eventually it's just a matter of time before they figure out, you know, where the hot spots are in the community for this kind of activity.
Yes, sir.
And so, you know, and the other alphabet agencies eager to become involved in this investigation. You gotta share with us some of the turn events, with especially regarding Police Commissioner Lee Brown, who would later become mayor of Houston.
Right.
Did you bring up, share with us some of that?
Absolutely. I certainly will. Okay. By the time the fourth, fifth murders or the kids were missing as well as murdered, a number of the mothers, one of them was the mother of, I'm just looking in the notes to make sure that I'm on point, sir. I apologize.
Okay.
Yusuf Bell's mother, Angel Lanier's mother, and Jeffrey Mathis's mother. They got together with a man named Reverend Earl Carroll, and they formed CORE. Camille Bell, she was basically the main mother who was an activist. Yusuf Bell's mother. They formed STOP. STOP succeeded in drawing attention to the murders early on and forcing Lee Brown and George Knapper to acknowledge that, these murders are connected. Because early on, the police, they wouldn't connect the murders.
Right.
CORE came in from New York City. CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, is led by Roy Ennis.
Mm-hmm.
He came to Atlanta around 81, and Roy Ennis worked with the FBI. He worked with John Glover, who was the major, he was basically like the head man of the FBI team that was stationed in Atlanta. And John Glover, you know, he's a black guy. Roy Ennis is the one who approached Shirley MacGill. Now, allegedly, Ennis, he had a picture of Parnell Tram. And he was actually circulating this picture in the neighborhood, and he threatened to arrest Parnell Tram, make a citizen's arrest. He got involved because Ennis assumed that there was witchcraft, that the children were basically being sacrificed by a Wicca coven.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because around 1979, I want to say, there was an actual murder. That I don't know how else you could describe it, but it was an actual murder where this girl, this white teenage girl, she was in some ceremony with some witches in Atlanta, and she was actually killed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the third major activist group was the Bat Patrol. They were carrying bats around Techwood homes. The Bat Patrol was formed by a local activist with the residents of Techwood homes. They were determined to defend themselves, and so they went to the media. They went to the APD, the Special Task Force. And they were like, look, we can't tolerate this. We're not going to take this, and we're going to defend ourselves. Lee Brown basically undermined the Bat Patrol by saying because they were living in public housing, they had no right to carry weapons.
That is untrue.
Right.
He lied.
Yep. And the whole thing at the time is that the APD with the East Point Police, the FBI, I want to say even the GBI, they formed what is considered the Special Task Force. Some people call it the Task Force, some people call it the Special Task Force. It was an amalgamation, a union, a joint venture of law enforcement agencies that were designated to solve the case at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's who basically was scoping out Atlanta, and they're the ones that allegedly nailed Wayne Williams when he was driving across the Jackson Parkway Bridge, which is between Cobb County and Fulton County.
Yeah. So it and so when I was reading it, it looked to me like a race between the policing agencies trying to bring it in to the case, bringing into all this attention, the cases, all that, before stop and core. The Bat Patrols and all the private investigators hired by the community activist leaders could put together all the clues. And so they basically were doing, from where I was looking at, a cleanup operation.
Yes. Yes, sir. I would agree. Wayne Williams, he is a controversial figure. But one of the things that he is not, he's, as I was corrected actually by a detective in the cold case squad, Wayne Williams is officially not the Atlanta child killer.
Mm-hmm.
He's officially in prison because he was convicted of murdering two adults, one of whom they do not know how this man died. The two victims that Wayne Williams was tried and convicted of murdering were 27-year-old Nathaniel Cater and 21-year-old Jimmy Ray Payne. Payne disappeared around April 22nd, 1981. He was found stripped to his underwear in, like, one of the rivers around the city. The cause of death was labeled undetermined. It is assumed that he was asphyxiated, but at the time, they did not know how the man died. And so to basically save face in the eyes of the world and to basically keep quiet the homosexuality that was prevalent in what was considered the Bible Belt. Law enforcement basically did away with Wayne Williams. He was, like you said, Charles, a convenient patsy.
Right. Now, with all of this activity that you document thoroughly in your book regarding, you know, the sex trafficking, the rich businessmen, you know, looking for a convention town to come and I would say express their wicked, their perverse side. I would like to get into, you know, some of the if we can, some of these secrets, some of the secret societies that were involved in this kind of activity historically in this area, and their activities, how they may be influencing the sex rings and other kinds of perversity today. And right after, we'll take a break for a few moments.
Sure.
And when we come back, we'll like you would like for you to explain these kinds of things to us in a few moments.
Yes, sir.
That'd be okay?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well,
sure.
Okay. Anybody want to call in to speak with Brother Cisco Streetlove? The number is area code 323-580-5707. And we'll be right back after this break.
Black in public, black out loud, and black on purpose. For some, it's where your deprogramming begins, and it's where others on the path come for fellowship. Come on in and kick your shoes off. Visit us at www.facebook.com/blackinpublic. Put your fist in the air, y'all, because we're going to keep it black.
African Knowledge Beyond the Book appears every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. We are a literary society dedicated to the study of African-based psychoanalytical texts. We hope you will join us as we delve into the inner working of our African consciousness. African Knowledge Beyond the Book, every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time on blogtalkradio.com.
Join us for the sweetest show on internet radio, Honey Soul Radio, every Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Central, and 10 p.m. Eastern. Join your hostess, the Honey Diva, and Miss Lady P. Every Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Central, and 10 p.m. Eastern. Honey Soul Radio on blogtalkradio.com. Now add a little honey to your flavor.
Welcome. welcome to AfricanImpressions.com. African Impressions is a black-owned business that offers products made by the global African community. African Impressions offers the finest in African-made jewelry, craft, clothing, and so much more. As the renaissance of the African community rapidly approaches, you need to add acquiring products crafted by members of the global African family to your repertoire of activities. We must rediscover more of our ancient cultural habits, which we struggle to regain, and incorporate them into our daily lives. Support African craftsmen and women by shopping at AfricanImpressions.com today. Hope to see you there.
The Woman's Song Community Experience is an extension of the Woman's Song Facebook community. Woman's Song was created with the mission to promote sisterhood and solidarity amongst women of color the world over. The Community Experience radio broadcast is an outreach effort to bring lecturers, authors, healers, spiritualists, and others with the necessary information to assist us in our campaign to repair ourselves. Our community is in dire need of reformation. During this Renaissance period of awareness, we will honor the womb man, and we seek to bridge the gap of understanding, love, and the upliftment of our sisters in crisis. Will you join us? We need your help in bringing this new awakening to all who desire its enlightenment. Become a part of our commitment to elevation as we work together to lift the divine earth to their rightful places. Woman Song. She's singing.
Welcome back to African Conversations. We're joined with a guest, Cisco Street Love, author of Yesterday's Shame, The Atlanta Child Murders. And before the break, we were getting ready to go into the secret society connection with illicit activity of a sexual nature in the Atlanta area. Brother Street Love.
Yes, sir.
We have a caller online. Would you mind taking a call?
Sure. No problem at all.
We'll call 52, Brother Warren. Hello?
Sir Charles, how you doing this evening?
Oh, fine and you today.
I'm good.
You have a question or comment for our guest?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to, I've enjoyed the show thus far, and I can't stay because I do have engagement tonight, but I did want to chime in on the conversation and listen to Brother Street Love talking about the Atlanta child murders. And I heard him say that Wayne Williams was basically not responsible for the child murders, but basically the two adults. Well, the thing that puzzled me is that Wayne Williams didn't do much for his case. I mean, he appeared to be, if nothing else, he appeared to be guilty pretty much before everybody. And, how do we explain that? And on top of that, the child murder stopped completely after his arrest. So how is that explained?
Sure thing, sir. Truth be told, they didn't stop after he was arrested. A number of victims that were part of this sex ring, they were murdered after he was arrested. I was corrected, like I said, by a full-fledged detective and some other people in law enforcement. Yeah, it's inaccurate to call him the child murderer. For you to legally refer to him as a child killer, he has to have been, in Wayne Williams' case, okay, he has to have been charged in the murders of those kids. To date, this is 2012. That was all the way back in 1982 when he was convicted. He's never been charged in the death of any minor.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay.
And you know, a lot of the evidence surrounding Williams is circumstantial and faulty. It was basically a con job. He was basically in a no-win situation, sir. You're talking about somebody who's like 22, 23 years old. He, when you look at him, he was basically fighting a losing battle. He was acting out because he was 22, 23 years old. Even though, you know, you are a full-grown adult at, when you're 20 per se, you know, by the time you're older than 25, you get the idea that, you know, how ignorant you were. So what I'm saying to you is that Wayne Williams is far from the criminal mastermind that they portrayed him to be. He was a convenient patsy because it made sense in the eyes of the white establishment that a black man be responsible for the murders of black kids in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He is not even linked to a number of the victims that were murdered. I'll give you an example. One of the victims who was murdered, Clifford Jones, he was killed in August of 1980. Several eyewitnesses pointed to Jamie Brooks being his killer. Jamie Brooks, despite what is posted online, a lot of people, when they hear that he was the manager of a laundromat, they assume that he was a white male. No, Jamie Brooks was a 29-year-old homosexual pedophile. He operated a laundromat in the Hollywood Shopping Plaza around Northwest Atlanta. He was linked to Michael McIntosh, who would later be found murdered himself. Jamie Brooks habitually raped boys. He, for this whatever particular reason, he felt like he had to flex on his employees. And he made an example of Clifford Jones. He sodomized him, then he strangled him in front of several witnesses. There were other witnesses that saw around the neighborhood him carry out what appeared to have been Clifford Jones' body and deposit it around the dumpster where Clifford Jones' body was found early that morning. Brooks himself, although he was allegedly cleared through a polygraph, he was later convicted of sexually assaulting another boy, and he died in prison of AIDS some years later. So that's the environment that you had in Atlanta.
Yeah, I know the media is very good at pretty much, I would say, deceiving or making people believe what they want us to believe. I understand that. But the thing that got my attention is, you know, as you say, I wasn't familiar with the murder, that the murder didn't stop. That's what the media said. The murder stopped after Wayne Williams was locked up. But they did an interview with him not too long ago. And, you know, I don't know, maybe there's a mental issue with him or something, because even then, here 20-something years later, he still didn't say much in his defense. I'm sitting here looking and waiting for him to say something that would, you know, convince me or anybody else that was watching the show. And he still didn't do that. So
he's not going to
implement
yeah.
you. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay, I will say this, and there's nothing much that he could say because he didn't interact with a lot of those victims. He didn't know about Clifford Jones. He didn't interact with him. A number of the only victim that he interacted with was JoJo Bell. Here's the thing with Wayne Williams. I always maintain that he deserves a retrial, at the very least. He may have, and I caution you, he may have, because he was a photographer, he may have been part of the picture taking. You're talking about a multi-tiered mainstream pedophile child prostitution ring. There were players, for example, that were taking pictures of these kids. They were getting their cut. It's possible that Williams took pictures of some of the victims and some other kids around Atlanta. But he's not the killer. You get what I'm saying, sir?
Yeah. Well, another thing, and I kind of have a personal, I'm going to say this, and I don't want to take up the line too long for anybody else who may want to call in. But I understand why, when you say it would make sense to have someone black doing it, because I'm pretty sure if it was a European, it would have set off a riot in Atlanta, if not worldwide, and which they are pretty much profound in doing that. My mind went back to, I'm 40 years old now, but my mind went back to a situation that happened to me when I was about 7 or 8. Playing on the corner of the street, and back then I had a long jerry curl, my hair was long, and had a white man pull up next to me here in Houston, Texas, and asked me that I want to go for no, I think he asked me. Oh yeah, he asked me that I want a date. I didn't know what he was talking about back then. I take that back. I did know what he was talking about, but I'm snapping and I'm like, want a date? And I told him, you know, I couldn't have been no more 7 or 8 years old. I said, I'm a boy,
you know.
And then yes. He said, oh, okay. You still want to go? You still want to date? You still want to go to the hotel room? And I'm like, no. So, had my mother, had instilled in me to not to get in the car with strangers or something, who knows what would have happened to me back then? I may have been raped, killed, and whatever else. So,
yes.
I can see that. But, you know, my thing is that even I've pretty much watched that story on the whole thing on the Atlanta child murders, and I always was looking for Wayne to say something that would speak to his defense, and I never got that. But that's why
right.
I pretty much became convincing to me that maybe he was the one that did it. You know?
I understand.
Yeah, I never go with the media's selection. Whatever, because they get their targets from the alphabet people. And they tell them who to start a character assassinating and holding court in on television and paper. So whoever the media is pointing to is most likely not to be the person.
Right.
That's just a rule of thumb. If they tell you look east, you look west. Yeah. Thank you for your call.
All
right.
You got it, sir. And look, I didn't mean to make light of what happened to you when you were a kid. It's just that I experienced something similar too, and I've heard so many other people. That's why I laughed instinctively, you know.
Oh no, I didn't take it. I'm a hard shell. I didn't bother me at all. But yeah,
I want to say to you, I'll give you an example of how horrible this case is being covered up. That piece of journalism that Soledad O'Brien had on CNN, that is completely misleading. I'll give you an example. Patrick Balthazar, he's not the crux of the case. Neither is JoJo Bell. The one that they should have focused on was Timothy Hill. Timothy Hill, along with Michael McIntosh and Patrick Rogers, those are the victims that a lot of the other victims interacted with. Then you had a case where Angel Bacon, I believe that was her name. She was murdered around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
She was a 14-year-old girl. She got in the car with a guy named Gates. Gates was an older black gentleman. He was like 59 years old. I forget his first name. She basically screamed, stormed out of the car. He backed the car over her. He ran her over, killed her.
Right.
Gates was also linked to John Porter. John Porter himself was a pedophile. He was tacked on to the victims list once Wayne Williams was apprehended. But there are strong allegations that Gates, this Gates character, he was the one that stabbed to death John Porter. So you have elements like that throughout this whole case where you have the victim. When you hear about the victims, they knew each other. Yes, a lot of them knew each other because a lot of them grew up in the same neighborhoods and they were part of the same sex ring.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that, Charles, you asked, you know, you wanted me to name some of the players in these rings.
Right.
A lot of the organizations that take part in these rings, the Boule that you hear about, the black
bourgeoisie
griffins that they're like the black Freemasons,
mm-hmm.
The Ku Klux Klan. The Ku Klux Klan is not just a hate group. They're America's most infamous occultic organization. The Mafia, a.k.a. La Cosa Nostra. The Catholic Church. The Jewish crime organizations.
B'nai B'rith.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with you on that one. And you had players like Michael Thieves, who had his own pornographic empire throughout America. He was one of the premier pornographers, and he dealt in child pornography circa the 60s and 70s. And his organization was still around into the 1980s, even though he was incarcerated. You also had very well-heeled individuals like a character named Francis Sheldon, who lived in, I want to say, Ann Arbor, Michigan. He ran a major, major pedophile ring, one of the first nationwide pedophile rings that was busted up by law enforcement around 1976. Francis Sheldon died a fugitive of justice in the 90s, and he was basically like a, how can I put it? He was a privileged child of the Michigan elite. His grandfather was one of the early founders, like, of the state of Michigan, and his father helped found the General Motors financial arm, General Motors or Ford. Francis Sheldon ran a major operation in Michigan off of North Fox Island, and he had a confidant, associate named Christopher Brian Bush, who is one of the main suspects in the Oakland County child killings that you hear about that took place between 76 and 77. So you have a lot of well-heeled clandestine people that are a part of this practice of pederasty. Pederasty, to be exact, is called pederasty. Pederasty is the practice of men as a sign of wealth having boy lovers. it was practiced in Asia Minor, and that's what a lot of the clandestine organizations indulge in. And you also have government officials, lobbyists, people with the CIA, a number of associates of the Bush family, both George W. Bush and his father, George Herbert Walker Bush. They are linked to this abuse of boys. There are girls that are part of the sex rings, but the main money that they would make was with the boys.
Right. Now, not to diverge from this, but I want to connect what you have researched, and I believe if you've heard of Credo Mutwa, the Zulu Sansui. Have you heard and read any of his books or heard any of his lectures?
No, I haven't, sir.
Well, he mentions in some of his lectures that he actually watched a sacrifice, human sacrifice ritual. He was snuck into a house of initiation by one of these clandestine organizations. Someone he knew was a janitor. And he gained information. That person had snuck him in, and he saw it. And on another occasion, he was hired because he was clairvoyant. Some parents wanted him to locate some children. And when they gave him some articles of clothing, and he saw who had the children. And once he followed them, he saw through second sight who was present with those kids. He said he stopped right then. He said he quit because the people who was involved in it were powerful people, and there would be no way that people would be able to prosecute these guys. He walked away from the case. This was like,
yes.
Right. This is the situation with the audience needs to know is that people who are doing this aren't who are basically running it. Much like the with the prison in Iraq, the where they were doing all of the criminal sex acts, and then they blamed
yes.
it on a few jailers.
Yes.
They're being brought into the structure of it, the infrastructure of the sex abuse initiation ring. But the people who run it and who mainly practice more deeply into it, they're basically untouchable.
Yes. They're bankers, they're store magnates, they're high-ranking politicians, they have enforcement of the mafia, as well as some of the kids they've molested. These are the forces that indulge in pederasty and a lot of times, Charles, they kill kids to intimidate the other victims. Like, if you kill 1-2 kids each year, that will help intimidate the 200 kids that you're molesting within your ring.
Right. See what happened to Billy. You want to turn up like him, you know? No,
exactly.
So you better do
yes.
what you mean business, that sort of thing.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
That's what the sacrifices are for.
And another level of it, right? The ritual.
They're using the cover of mysticism to basically terrorize and intimidate the victims into pederasty.
Right. Exactly.
Now, you have some, and I will caution some, that allegedly practice sexual magic, where they feed off of the ectoplasmic energy of minors, and usually boys. And when they have sex, you know, they hold their orgasms and they have remote viewing.
Right. And that can be depicted in one film called The Sale, where the guy has
yes.
the number. He watches the ladies drown, and then he climaxes upon their death. And Cradle talked about that too. He said when the victim was, they had to hold themselves until the moment of death, and then other than that, they claimed that it wouldn't work or something like to that effect. But you know, but another question, Brother Warren, is that all the questions that you have for Brother Cisco? Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I was with Warren.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any more questions? But.
Oh, no, that'll be it. I enjoy the show. I'd like to stay, but I got another engagement, so I didn't
want
to chime in on a very interesting subject.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate you for calling in. And have a good night.
You too. Thank you, brother.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah, and yes, and this network that functions, you know, they function at primarily to prey upon, like you said, poverty-stricken children who are they have a weak family social structure. I mean, they don't have a strong unit looking out for them. The community isn't vigilant, watching out for all the young, and so these basically they're like wolves that
right.
you know, looking. That's what we can say. That's why they promote dysfunctional families in our community. Because as long as our families are dysfunctional, they want us to continue to have lots of sex, breed children that are underprotected, undernourished, and so that they will be future victims for them to feed upon.
Yes, sir.
Right. So it's, you know, so important that we that we face reality, that this, you know, that things aren't what the news media and other things often want to project. They project the hideous side every now and again, but people like to shy away and cringe when they see that face. But that's the face of what's really going on. You know.
And then too, one of the things with law enforcement, at the very base reality, the Atlanta murders were perpetrated by more than one person. One of the things that law enforcement does not like to deal with is when you have a crime syndicate. When you have a crime syndicate, you have a lot of peripheral murders, you have multiple killings where you have a lot of suspects, and it takes extra work to find out the actual guilty parties.
Right.
And so a lot of law enforcement, some of them are in on the alleged fund. Some people are just, you know, lazy and trifling. That they don't want to do the work to find the actual culprits. That's why when you have organized crime, like the typical organized crime is racketeering and narcotics trafficking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You will have murders committed, and that's why you have the mafia, because law enforcement, they don't want to say, well, was it the Lucchese crime family? Was it the Gambino crime family? Was it the Bonanno crime family? We don't. It's too much work. We don't know.
Right. And they have informants in all these families.
Yes.
And all these families have informants in their agencies. So
yep.
Based on the information transfer that they have within these organizations, you would think it'd be relatively easy for them to get some information about who is on whose hit list.
Yep.
You know, but we all, you know, can see that they don't want to do that kind of work. That's a good, you know, example. Frank Serfico.
Yes. Yes.
His case. He uncovered all of this criminal activity in the NYPD. And he ended up having to leave the country because it was so bad it went up all the way beyond the mayor's office.
Yes.
And so he just had to go if he wanted to live.
That's
know?
Like, yeah, that's like you had in like when the, I'm sure you've seen American Gangster, Charles.
Yes.
That's the, you know, that story about Frank Lucas.
Yes.
He that's, you know, a lot of people don't realize he was part of a super syndicate with Nicky Barnes. They all worked with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to the point where when Frank Lucas and some other guys were on trial around 1974, there were two informants that were murdered, or two gangsters that were murdered that the government, they basically wanted to use these guys as cooperating witnesses or informants. They always thought that it was Frank Lucas's actual crew, the Country Boys, that murdered these guys. It turned out years later that it was Nicky Barnes' counsel that had these two individuals murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a lot of that with these sex rings, because you have like these multiple circles, these multiple layers. It's like a, it's literally like a spider's web.
Yeah, they're all killing people and raping and prostituting. You know, you never know who exactly did that particular one that we're looking at.
Yes.
You never know.
And in the case of the Atlanta murders, it's a strong possibility that some of the latter victims very well could have murdered some of the earlier victims.
Right. Right, because that's how they do. They back out as they're dismantling the operation. Everybody
yes.
who could potentially get desperate at any point in time and point some fingers, they got to clean it up. People start coming up missing, and all the way until it reaches the level where nobody else gets hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I also want to. Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I just wanted to also add in that I beg everyone to not just look at what happened in Atlanta. Look at what happened in the case of the Freeway Phantom, that was the killer or killers in the D.C. metropolitan area that killed several black girls between 1971 and 72. And also look at the Oakland County child killings, where you had white minors that were murdered. It is my belief that all three cases are linked, and those murders were part of a larger ritual.
Mm-hmm. See that?
So, you know, don't just look at what went on in Atlanta. Look at what happened around the country, because guess what? These sex rings, they operate nationwide.
And you know, I like to throw in this, like, this example for people who may find this, like, difficult to digest. Look at the transatlantic human trafficking ring run by several nations. And within several nations, there were several corporations and finance companies and shipping businesses and, you know, and soldiers of fortune and all of these people, pirates, all involved in one plan to destabilize militarily, socially, economically, in any other kind of way possible, social life, on the African continent for the express purpose of harvesting all of the human and mineral wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, and our ancestors were carried from there all over the planet. Some remained were allowed to work the land.
Yep.
And we can argue which nation killed the most. There's some that I've seen said Portugal did most of the human trafficking from Africa, of our ancestors.
Yep.
And they say, well, Britain did the least. But the point is, it was all one big plan. You see? And so it's no different when you look at this kind of criminal activity here, because it was the same criminal activity. It involved kidnapping, rape, murder, exploitation of all of every kind, any crime imaginable and unimaginable was done by that international criminal cartel headquartered in Europe. And so we have we're living in their colony here, in what we call the America. This is a colony still, because it's there that these people, the people who run this land, are not indigenous to it. And they're carrying out the same activity that they've always carried out.
Yep.
And we have to realize that this is just a continuation of everything that has befallen us from the time we encountered them in this human trafficking network. It's more human trafficking, more exploitation, more murder. And it began with assistance from our people, and it continues with assistance from our people. What do you have to say on that, Bill Sisko?
I agree, Charles. It's you said it. I'll give you an example. There's a major media corporation, Time Warner. The crux of the Time Warner Corporation was Kinney, the Kinney Corporation. They ran, like, you know, summary businesses. They had parking lots, cleaning services. They bought DC Comics. And the guy, Steve Ross, who ran Kinney, he ultimately purchased Warner Communications. And decades later, that's the mega media conglomerate that we have today. The key is the Kinney Corporation was basically financed by the mob. If you know, they caught Fat Tony Salerno, a major criminal in the New York area. He was bragging about how the mob had a hand in the Kinney Corporation. And that's one of the reasons why when you picked up the comic books, DC Comics, for example, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, the Justice League of America, the Super Friends, They never mentioned the Mafia.
Right.
Because the Mafia helped distribute the comics at the time, amongst other publications. So for all the goody two-shoes fiction that is presented to the populace, the foundation of a lot of these enterprises is built on crime. And these are the same people that lecture our people about, you know, no cheating and do it the right way. And in reality, a lot of the businesses, the enterprises that reach prominence in America, they were built on criminal activity. That's like when you hear about Disney Corporation, to basically make more money, help distribute pornography.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, so a lot of the things that whites do are far from noble. They know every bit about this criminal underworld, this underground economy.
Right.
But they always lecture our people to take their word and to, you know, basically believe what they present us.
And trust them, too.
Yes.
Because we had better sense, we wouldn't send our children to their schools.
Yeah.
Or anything else they had, because we would know them for what they really are.
Yes, sir.
You know, you document so much great information in your book, you know, that really help a person to get a firm handle on these rings, and I think we discussed it the previous time about future research, and you know, if you feel like going into that, you know, we can the many other details that we could bring up, like one of the I wanted to look, like, I think we were on Tracy Gilmore's program. And y'all were discussing Trayvon Martin as a possible target by the homosexual male predator Zimmerman. I believe that we were talking about that in that program. But
sure.
I think I heard you mention some details about his home computer and linking that back to what you have shown us in your book, Yesterday's Shame, we can see that Trayvon, I mean, Zimmerman could have been functioning as a possible operative in this same kind of network, being that his grandfather or father was a judge, to my another problem.
Yes, sir.
In the power structure again, and Zimmerman being a homosexual or bisexual, whatever kind of sexual, we know he's a pervert, and he was hunting a young black or African male boy. Could you elaborate? Is anything like the same connection with what your kind of research that you've exposed?
Yes, sir, Charles. I caution everyone to not be intimidated by George Zimmerman or a lot of white males who exercise his behavior. Zimmerman, once he was basically arrested, or just before he was arrested, there was news that he basically had black gay pornography on his home computer. One of the things that I said to Tracy, and I'm certain of, is that George Zimmerman is a homosexual. To follow a kid around the way he did,
mm-hmm.
and to basically, you know, get into a physical altercation with a younger individual, that's nothing but pedophilic homosexual behavior. There was no justifiable reason that Trayvon Martin should be dead.
Or even
a
having
lot
a...
of.
Hello?
I'm sorry.
Now, I
yes,
was just
sir.
Adding to what you were saying. Or even had some altercation with him. Right. I was
exactly.
adding to you.
Exactly.
Right.
Yep. And, you know, Zimmerman, a lot of the so-called racist cops, it is a modus operandi of white males to emasculate black males at every turn. And a lot of the white males that a lot of our people are intimidated by, these guys are homosexuals. They're pederasts. It's grotesque to think about. It's a hard topic to, you know, cover. But yes, a lot of white males are homosexuals. Homosexuality, that's part of their rites of passage, because to them, sex is not romantic per se, it's about power. So they basically exert power by raping, having sex with boys and even other men.
Right.
And I came across that research far too much while I was composing this book. I wish I could say to our people more and more that, look, these white guys that you are so intimidated by, they're gay.
Yeah.
They covet men more than they do women. So you need to, like, purge yourself of a lot of the fears you have with white males.
That's so true. I believe that's one of the reasons they have with this penis envy.
Yes.
Because when I was in high school, there was this, it was this white boy. He wanted to challenge all the black guys in the gym to a measuring contest. And we all just like blow, like we was like laughing, like, this guy's crazy. His white friends was like,
yes.
trying to come get him, but he was like, he really wanted to prove or really show us his penis. And even if, you know, in his with gym class, we knew that something was wrong with this guy, that was not the real reason that he wanted to, you know, prove his masculinity more than that. He actually wanted to look at black penises. And so I saw that as reflective of his culture. As I got older, and I saw like that's what they kept talking about. You know, that's all they talk about was their penis in contrast to our penis. And we should make fun of people that did. We say they was dick watchers. You're not supposed to be concerned about nobody else's penis. Why do you give a care? And the only reason I could come up with it, I was a young adult, was that they're homosexual. That's why they care.
It's one of those things that, you know, like I said before, Charles, we can't rationalize irrational behavior. But yes, these white males, they're gay. Before I forget, I want to say thanks to, you mentioned her, Tracy Gilmore. She really helped me finish that book, and, you know, despite what Amazon has on their site, yes, she is the one that came up with that cover, and I'm glad you have that in your flyer. She did that cover. She's a great graphic designer, and, you know, she really helped me finish that book and bring it home.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the flyer she did, too, for this event, man. It's really nice.
Yeah. I'll always be indebted to Tracy, and I hope she's listening.
Yes, she is. And that's how I know about you, because I was tuning into a show, and you were on talking about this subject, talking about your book and research, and it gripped me, because I remember that time back in 81, and it gripped the black neighborhoods everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that the Klan was out kidnapping kids. Not that that was improbable, but so we were carrying knives to school in the fifth grade, fourth and fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody. I mean, back then, you know, people, parents weren't like these parents today. They all pick up their kids at the school door. You know, you were prepared for man, preparing you more for manhood. If you got it, can get you hold of a BB gun and take it with you, well, go head on. you better not miss. You better shoot him. You know, and people, we should look out. Like, we saw another kid being hassled by somebody. We didn't just let that person get carried off, you know. I don't know how people are today, but we wasn't like that back in the early 80s. So the black community was on high alert at that time.
Exactly.
And so, which, like, the bad squad was right on the money doing what they were doing. They just shouldn't have gone to the police and told them that, hey, we're gonna be patrolling with bats. I don't know whose idea that was, but you know, that's how it went. You know, but we have to, you know, keep, you know, we have to read and support researchers like yourself so that we can really stay abreast of the facts of the case. We have to have our own researchers, and you're one of our own, and we should read your work, and anybody else that has truth, we should be, I would say, wise and prudent to, you know, not just take information from someone who has an interest in deceiving us, you know.
Can I say this to you, sir?
Yeah, sure.
I appreciate, you know, your venue, what you and your wife are doing, as well as what Tracy's doing, because it's sorely needed. With that in mind, I want to say this about this case and about the murders that took place in the 70s. What it appears to be, from the Freeway Phantom case to the Atlanta Child murders, these murders were orchestrated by some individuals on a major national clandestine level. In the decades prior, the 50s, 60s, and you had basically kids that were being put on errands by their parents, by, you know, their by adults in the neighborhood. It seems like in a lot of these cases, by the 1970s, the killers were preying on the standard behavior in neighborhoods. Furthermore, in Atlanta, and I can't say this enough, a number of the victims that were found murdered, that were missing, they're found murdered, they were found murdered in DeKalb County, and one of them was found murdered in Rockdale County. To get to Rockdale County from Atlanta, you basically have to go to through the cab. At the time of the killings, DeKalb County was overwhelmingly white. So it wasn't so much Wayne Williams, it was more of these white people around North DeKalb County, and to this day, it's a big Orthodox Jewish population that still rests in northern DeKalb County. Look into that area. Yes, sir. Look into that area, and you will find the culprits of those murders. And they were people that they were bringing these kids to the hotels, if not to... You have to remember, during this time, yesterday as well as today, you have guys that they can have a second home.
Right.
And that second home is to have sex.
Right, a second apartment.
So it could be, right, a second apartment or even a full-fledged house.
Right.
And they can bring, you know, a companion there. And because these people are the sole owners and their families aren't at these houses, they could do whatever they want with whoever they bring there.
Right.
So they were paying a lot of these kids, and they were luring them, you know, like, you know, you want to make money for tonight, you know, I'll do something for you. And that's how they strangled them.
Right.
I know it's not an easy subject to talk about, but I would encourage a lot of people to basically invest the time, and it's going to help the community a lot to get to the truth of who we're dealing with.
Right. And that they have influence and not influence, they have membership in every sector of society that is influential and or powerful.
Yes, sir.
And if someone possesses power to influence policy at any level of society, they are a suspect because they can prevent things from, you know, happening. They can shape, you know, they have control basically over an opinion of mass groups of people. And,
yes, sir.
And I know in your book you cover, Eddie Long, and in his case, that's an interesting chapter, you know, for everyone to read. But, you know, a person like him, you know, we've heard of cases of clergy, whether they be Protestant clergy or Catholic clergy or Orthodox Jewish rabbis in Israel or here involved in organ harvesting, children kidnapping. You see all these people who are powerful, and they're all involved in pederastry and organ and all these heinous criminal activities.
Yes.
And it's, you know, and these are heinous criminal acts that sustain the culture of human, of African trafficking. I mean, Frederick Douglass said in his autobiography, he said being on the plantation of a religious person was the worst place to be.
Mm-hmm.
He said they were the cruelest, most vile person to be held captive. Harry Jekyll said the same thing. They were the biggest hypocrites. And nothing has changed 150 years later, you know, except today we haven't read the works of our ancestors that told us about the child rape. And Frederick Douglass talked about this in his book about women, and Harry Jekyll talked about they were glad when they had a boy instead of a girl because they were less likely to be raped in certain cases, you know. But knowing what we know about the sex farms in the antebellum period, you know, it wasn't to be done. They were less likely to rape the boys, in a, you know, in just on any plantation. But perhaps like I postulated, or you possibly, we both discussed that they probably did this much of the male pederasty in a specific location. So they don't, because they didn't
a
want
lot.
Right. They didn't want,
yes,
that information to be too freely dispersed that they were involved in this. So they had particular hubs or headquarters where they would go and indulge themselves in this kind of conduct. What would you have to say about that?
I would say to people this. You have bestiality in the here and now that white people, more white people than black people. There are some cases of black people, but more white people take part in bestiality, having sex with dogs, having sex with even horses. You could only imagine, given that our people were considered beasts of burden, you had slave owners. And remember, these are people who dehumanized other human beings. So you can imagine they had slave plantations for the express purposes of breeding, and then they had slave quarters for the express purposes of sexual gratification, recreation for the slave owners and white males.
Right.
So if you have, in the here and now, men who have sex with chickens, you can only imagine how many white men had sex with little boys and girls who were enslaved.
Right.
That's a given.
Right.
Our people were treated basically like beasts of burdens, and we were genetically engineered. That's why when the NFL was first launched, there was a period where the Green Bay Packers and the Chicago Bears got together, and they banned black males from playing in the NFL. So they knew all about our prowess and, you know, our powers and abilities, because basically we were genetically engineered. They created us. They engineered black people like you do, well, like you breed dogs and horses.
Right, husbandry. They practice African husbandry on us.
Yes.
Right.
And that did not stop as slavery ended. A lot of white men are gay, and, you know, look no further, for example, than the Stepford Wives. That's a classic science fiction story, even some would consider it a black comedy. But the premise is that these are guys who are killing their wives and replacing them with robots.
That's right.
For you to do that, you nothing but a homosexual.
Right.
But that's what they did in America, and that's how they got down in Atlanta, or in the South. Atlanta in particular, one of the things about Atlanta is it's not a place where you have a lot of manufacturing like in the North and in other regions where you have blue-collar, entrenched blue-collar middle-class base, where you have people working with their hands and they're a large part of the community. Atlanta is more of a white-collar service sector city. You have bankers, doctors, lawyers, architects, teachers that were a great part of the population. Because you didn't have guys that got their hands dirty, per se, that fostered a huge, huge gay population to be in Atlanta, in addition to it being a big city, the capital of the Southeast, and a high-profile city. Because, you know, men like to be where the action is.
Right.
So that's how the homosexual population flourished in Atlanta. And within that population, yes, you have men yesterday as well as today that are dedicated to pederasty. And that's what you had in Atlanta during the time of those murders.
Right, and that's the right. That's the climate that produced the murdering spree that we remember and were lied to grossly in the media, and evidently many people, or a few people in our community, began to agree, accept the false reports given by the propaganda matrix.
Yes.
Right. Well.
Now, Wayne Williams, there, if you, it's this obscure documentary made by William Scarborough. William Scarborough is one of the people that helped me. He provided me some information. Wayne Williams basically worked with the CIA. One of Williams' handlers was a guy named Gerald Rafshoon. Gerald Rafshoon, he went on to produce the documentary, The Atlanta Child Murders, that was aired in 1985, on CBS, the docudrama. It was like, a three-part miniseries.
Right.
Another handler of Wayne Williams was a guy named Michael Gleam. Gleam was in the Air Force. He's a white male. Believe it or not, sometime in the 1990s, even though Michael Gleam was an attorney, he was basically a well-to-do guy, he was also, he ran with the wrong crowd. He was a drug dealer. Well, somebody in his circle killed their wife. Gleam tried to hide her body in his personal airplane, his mini plane. When, you know how they have those personal airplanes?
Mm-hmm.
The authorities caught him, and he's serving a life sentence in the state of Georgia for this woman's murder. But these are the characters that Wayne Williams was exposed to. At the end of the documentary, Wayne Williams states that he was part of the CIA's program that was basically doing genetic research in Africa.
Wow.
He basically alludes to them doing research on AIDS before AIDS was full-blown in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing with Wayne Williams, too, is that he was into music. He was a music producer, and he didn't come from a family. What he basically tried to do was... Are you familiar with the movie The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh?
No, I'm not.
Okay, The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh is this movie where it's a comedy where they form this professional basketball team on Pisces. All the players of the franchise, they're Pisces.
Okay.
Wayne Williams, I believe his zodiac sign is Gemini. He basically tried to have a music group, called Gemini, that was made with kids of the same zodiac.
Oh.
Now, interestingly, immediately after his conviction, for those who follow music, his take on the boy bands was appropriated by a number of people in R&B and later pop music. Because at the time of his arrest and incarceration, boy bands that he was working on weren't that popular. But the minute after he was incarcerated, that's when you have New Edition, that's when you had Musical Youth, that's when you had, you know, the white band New Kids on the Block.
Right.
Throughout the 80s. So he was potentially ahead of his time had he been free. And he's not a stupid guy. He wasn't stupid. He wasn't outright sinister. He was just in the wrong crowd.
Right.
But I caution everyone, he's not the killer.
Right. She's not the killer. He, you know, the music industry is just full of sordid individuals. And he was, you know, fishing around that pool of sharks, you know, trying to come up with a no hustle. He had a brilliant idea, but just working on it. And the time was just all wrong, you know. And, you know, it's just bad him looking for, trying to find young talent at that time. It was just really bad idea. He should have just laid out, put that one on ice. Mm-hmm. You know, but I had to stand and offer that. Anyone like to make a call and ask Brother Cisco a question? I don't know how much time I think we have just a few minutes left in this broadcast, but if you want to call in, the area code is 323-580-5707. And you can continue with that.
Okay.
You know, just for a few minutes. You can mention, let people know how they can contact you on Facebook and the other outlets, the gain more understanding about these types of situations, and most importantly, how they can acquire your book and learn all the interesting details that help us become infinitely savvy on this subject of black child victimization, particularly in the Atlanta area in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yes, sir. The book Yesterday's Shame is available on Amazon.com. It's downloadable. If you have a Kindle, or even if you don't have a Kindle, you should be able to download it, and it's $8.99. You can contact me on Facebook. I have a general Facebook page, Cisco Street Love. There's also a page dedicated to Yesterday's Shame. And, if anyone wants to contribute, anyone has any information, you can contact me by messaging me through those devices.
Great. Great, thank you. Back to the issue before we close out. This is the most important issue, and it's still going on, and all these events are happening. Some of them are highly publicized, some are not. But I believe we have a call from area code 414. You are live on the line with Brother Cisco Street Love.
Hi, this is Tracy. I was just calling to say it's a great show.
Oh, hey, how you doing, Tracy?
I'm exploring everything.
Thank you. Tracy, it couldn't have been done without you, so thank you once again.
Oh, okay. She act like I wrote the book, okay? Mr. Street Love. I just called to say it was a great show. I actually enjoyed it. I'm glad I stayed home. So, any thumbs up?
Thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you, Charles.
Oh, you're welcome. I just wanted to mention that we're about to go into overtime if anybody else doesn't have anything to say.
Okay.
But the number is 323-580-5707. Dial in so you can continue to listen to the podcast into the next hour. Okay, you can continue. Thanks.
Are you still there, Tracy? Oh, she hung up. You really did a great job on that cover, and you really helped me cinch it up with the quickness.
Oh, well, thanks. Like I said, you know, wouldn't have been a book without you. So, and I'm going to go back into to the audience, so to speak, and sit back and listen. So I just wanted to chime in to say, hey, you know, I'm enjoying the show. So, all right.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thanks for calling in, Tracy.
No problem.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I think that's a wrap. I appreciate you for coming on, sharing information. You know how everybody in the audience know how to contact Brother Cisco Street Love and how to get your book with Yesterday's Shame, the Atlanta Child Murders. And we thank you all, everyone, for tuning in. to this live broadcast. Thank you for the calls, and we look forward to seeing you again next time we have a program. And thank you for Brother Street Love for coming on, and hope you when your next project, a major project, you get together, and would you come on and share it with us on then too.
You've got it, sir, and thank you once again.
Okay, and you're welcome. You're more than welcome to come on here anytime. And we bid you all a great weekend, and thank you for joining us here on African Conversation. Good night.
Good night.
You've got to fight, fight, fight.